morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning, taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, we'll be glad to talk to you about that. If you've got issues you're dealing with in your own spiritual journey, you can call and we can talk about those things. If you have challenges to the Bible or to the Christian faith, that is, if you're not a convinced Christian and you think there are problems with the Bible or with Christianity, I'd be glad to talk to you about that. If you're a Christian and you have a different viewpoint than mine, you can call about that. In other words, there's almost nothing that you can't call about, as long as it's related to something to do with your interactions with the Christian faith, with Christ, with God, with the Bible. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Our first call today is from Wynn, calling from Palos Verdes, California. Hi, Wynn, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul talked about before the coming of Jesus Christ and our gathering to him, there will be men of sin and lawlessness. And I would like to hear your view on this. Who is the man of sin and what is the lawlessness?
Okay, well, the man of sin obviously is a controversial figure mentioned only here by those terms. It's possible that the same person or entity is mentioned elsewhere in the Bible under other terms, though that is debatable. For example, many people would equate the man of sin or of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2 with the beast in Revelation 13, or with the little horn of Daniel 7, or the little horn of Daniel 11, or with the Antichrist of 1 John, or some of these other things. So these are all different terms used in different books, and some people think they're all talking about the same entity. Now, in my opinion, there's not a strong reason to identify the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians with all of these other passages, maybe with some of them, but not all of them. There is a tendency to be overly simplistic. And, you know, whenever you find a passage about a really bad person in the Bible, to say, well, that's the same really bad person that's in all these other passages about a really bad person. However, there's never been a shortage of really bad persons, and therefore we need to be careful not to just lump all these passages together as if they spoke about the same thing when they might not. I remember one of the most famous radio Bible teachers, who is still on every day, several times a day usually, when going through the book of Psalms, would sometimes be dealing with a psalm about the wicked. And it would be a generic psalm talking about the wicked and his interaction with the righteous and how he persecutes the righteous and so forth. And in the psalm, it's just a generic statement about wicked people doing bad things to righteous people. But this particular teacher would say, now this wicked person is the Antichrist that will rise in the end times, and the righteous person is the remnant of Israel in the tribulation and so forth. And there would be not one thing in the psalm to point that direction. And this would be just another example of just taking all the passages that are about really bad people and trying to make them be about one particular bad person. And the trend in popular eschatology today, especially dispensationalism, is to think the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians is the beast, the Antichrist, that it refers to a dictator who will rise up in the world in the end times during the Great Tribulation. This is the default view of many people who've never heard anything else. What's interesting is how many Christians are unaware of how new that view is. And what most Christians, especially most Protestant Christians throughout history, have thought otherwise. The view of Martin Luther, John Calvin, Zwingli, John Huss, Wycliffe, John Knox, all the reformers, was that the man of sin, or the son of perdition, that Paul mentions in 2 Thessalonians 2, is a reference to the rise of the papacy. Now, I'm not saying this is true, but I'm saying it was the uniform belief of all Protestants up until about the 19th century. And although uniform beliefs are sometimes wrong, it's rather surprising to us who don't, generally speaking, hear that view now. The idea that the man of sin was the papacy was one of the main ideas of the Reformation. In fact, you'll even find it mentioned in the King James Bible. If you have a King James Bible and you open at the very beginning of the King James Bible, there's a letter of dedication. The translators of the King James Bible dedicated the King James Bible to King James, and in their praise for the king, in the opening dedicatory epistle, they praise him for resisting that awful man of sin, that son of perdition, by which they mean the Pope, because everyone back then who was not a Catholic believed that the papacy was the man of sin. Interestingly, there were many who believed that even before the Reformation. The Franciscan order of monks believed that. So it was a very common view for centuries. It's not very common today. But I would just say that if you would read the reasons that the Reformers gave for identifying the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians with the papacy, you'd find that there are at least as many good arguments in favor of that view as there are of the more modern view. Now, what do I think? I really don't know. I mean, Paul speaks very vaguely about the man of sin. He says, you know that the man of sin is going to rise. You know what is hindering him. You know what will happen when he's taken out of the way, and so forth. Many Christians think this means that the church in the world, or the Holy Spirit residing in the church in the world, is preventing the Antichrist from rising. And when the rapture occurs, then the Antichrist will be revealed. Of course, that's not a possible interpretation of Paul's words, because he has already said a few verses earlier, at the beginning of the chapter, that the church can't be gathered to Jesus until after the man of sin rises. I mean, he makes that rather plain in the opening verses of 2 Thessalonians 2. So the man of sin has to rise before the church is gone, says Paul in very plain terms. So whoever is interpreting the passage to say that the church has to be removed first is reading something into it that isn't really a reasonable thing to read into it. The Reformers believed that the thing that was hindering the rise of the man of sin was the Roman Empire, and that the Roman Empire had to be taken out of the way. That is, the emperor's office had to be ended before the man of sin could rise. And so when the Roman Empire did fall and there were no more emperors, the fact that the papacy came to power in the power vacuum there in Europe encouraged the Reformers to see the papacy as the man of sin that rose up with the removal of the Roman Empire. Why did they think the Roman Empire was the thing that had to be removed? Because they identified the man of sin with the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. And if you read Daniel 7, the fourth beast, which is the Roman Empire, would be burned and destroyed, and then the little horn seems to be in power after that. So it was understood that the Roman Empire would have to be removed, then the little horn would rise. And so the Reformers all felt that that indeed had happened with the fall of the Roman Empire. Were they right? I really don't know. Paul is rather vague, and I will say this. I am as impressed, I think I'm more impressed with the arguments for the Reformed view than I am for the dispensational view on this. I hope that's helpful. I know I could be more specific, but I have lectures on this at our website, at thenarrowpath.com. The lectures are free for download. They're MP3 files. And if you go to the my verse-by-verse treatments of Thessalonians, you can get much more detail than I have time to give on the radio here. But Wynn, I hope that's helpful to you. Let's talk to next Dan from San Diego. Dan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Can you explain to me in Matthew where Jesus says, do not give what is holy to the dogs and cast your pearls before swine?
It's difficult to know exactly what Jesus has in mind. And the normal way that this is understood, and it may be correct, but it's hard to know if it's the only way Jesus could be understood on this, it's usually applied by Christians to say that you shouldn't continue trying to preach the gospel to people who are not of a mind to listen, who cannot appreciate the fact that the gospel is a message from God, a holy thing, like a valuable thing, like a pearl. Jesus said, don't cast your pearls before swine, and do not give what is holy to dogs. Of course, he said that in Matthew 7:6. And a pearl cannot be appreciated by a swan, by a pig, for the simple reason that pigs don't value gems and jewels. Pigs, all they look for is a meal. And if you throw a pearl at a pig, he's going to think you're throwing rocks at him. He might get angry and charge you. That's what Jesus said. He'll trample it under feet and charge you. He doesn't know that what you're casting toward him is something of immense value, because a pig does not have the capacity to recognize the value of a pearl. To him, it's just another small, hard object that's being thrown at him. And you don't give dogs what is holy. This is probably a reference in the Jewish setting to holy food that only priests were allowed to eat. You don't give that to dogs. Dogs, of course, like pigs, do not have the power to evaluate either, you know, the monetary value of gems, nor the spiritual value of holy things. Dogs, in their own thinking, can't distinguish between things that are holy and things that are not holy. And therefore, what Jesus is saying is, you don't really want to waste or misuse things of value or things that are sacred on, probably he means persons. He's not referring to real pigs and dogs. He's comparing certain kinds of people to pigs and dogs. You don't want to waste those things on people who simply do not have the capacity to appreciate them. Now, you wouldn't know if a person is in that category or not until you've at least begun to try to present the gospel to them. But if upon entering into such conversations you find that the person is simply sacrilegious, they don't value holy things, they don't care about truth, they don't see any worth in what you're saying, and after a short time, if you can't persuade them to see the value of it, move along. Don't just keep wasting things that are of value on persons who have no capacity to recognize them. There may be other applications of the principle that Jesus enunciates there, but I think that's the primary way that people have understood it generally, and I think that's probably correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Dan, thanks for your call. Good talking to you. Let's talk to Grace from Westminster, California next. And by the way, we have a line open for you at 1-800-227-5278. If you have any question about the Bible or about the Christian faith, you can call me. You don't have to agree with me, but you can hear what I have to say, and you just put that as one opinion. You can search for second and third opinions if you wish. The number is 1-800-227-5278. Grace, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, I have a comment. Last week you were talking to someone about Christian giving, and I would like to add to some of the things that you said. First of all, we in America are the richest country in the world, as I think everyone agrees. But we only give 5% of the money that we give to Christian work to the rest of the world. We give it to local ministries, which are important. But I would like to suggest uses for Christian money. One is Bible distribution. People need Bibles if they're going to grow in the Lord. Another is shortwave radio stations like HCJB, Transworld Radio, Far East Broadcasting, that broadcast the gospel into places where people don't have access to Christian preaching otherwise. And
So what you're saying, apparently, what you're saying is that although Christians in America give a great deal, they don't always give to places that are helping overseas. They're helping local ministries. I'm surprised that the statistic you mentioned, 5% alone, goes to things overseas, because I know of a lot of ministries supported by Christian dollars that are doing various kinds of work overseas, including Bible distribution. Actually, one of the causes that that I regularly support in my giving is helping the persecuted church and distributing Bibles and things like that. And my impression is that there's a lot of work being supported by Christian dollars in that area, and also radio, but also importantly, a lot of work helping poor people, feeding hungry people, and providing medical assistance. But you may be right. The statistic you're giving may be correct. I just wasn't aware of it. I'm surprised to hear it. If only 5% of our giving is going there, to those kinds of causes, then you may be right. It may be better for us to reevaluate the distribution. We certainly need to recognize that all the money that we have, whether it's the money we're giving or the money we're keeping or spending on ourselves, all of our money belongs to God. It's not ours. And the day will come when we give account for what we did with God's money. You see, we're not here just to play around with whatever we can get our hands on. We're here to be managers of whatever assets God gives us access to. If we make a lot of money at our job, if we inherit money, if we get if we just happen to live in a country where there's more money flowing and we, you know, we're better off than other people, that's not just so that we can have more fun than other people or be more comfortable than other people or just be more well-fed than other people. It's God's money, of which he's given a larger percentage to some of us than others, and those who have a larger percentage have a larger obligation. We will therefore be judged by what we have done with God's money once Jesus returns. At least I believe his parable of the talents and his parable of the pounds both make that point. Grace, I appreciate your call. Thank you. We're going to talk next to Ronnie from Claremont, California. Ronnie, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I have a question about Romans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where Paul says in a number of verses that we should obey the law, and I agree with that, but he also says that we should do good things, do this because if we do good things for the government, then they'll respond in kind. And then God has established all governments, which I can't quite agree with that, because take the government of Adolf Hitler, for example. And
yeah,
it may be a
I think people often misunderstand what Paul is getting at there. They sometimes think that Paul is saying anybody who's in power should be given our, you know, unilateral, unconditional support because they're all God's good guys. Well, they're certainly not. Paul knew that well enough. Paul got beheaded by Nero, who was the very emperor in power when he wrote the book of Romans. And Paul knew very well that Nero was not a good man. He was a killer and a torturer of many Christians. And as I say, Paul himself and Peter and perhaps some of the other apostles succumbed to the persecutions that Nero instigated. So Paul was certainly not trying to give the impression that all rulers are men of God. What he's saying is they are in a position that God has allowed them to be in as a responsible position. They are ordained by God to do something. Now, if we say that a minister in a pulpit has been ordained by God to preach the gospel, that doesn't mean that the minister actually will preach the gospel. It's what he's ordained to do. It's what he's commissioned to do. It's what he's required to do as a fulfillment of his post. But it doesn't tell us whether he will do it or not. A man may be ordained to preach the gospel and never preach a single gospel. He might preach a false gospel. He might do something entirely different than preach. So to say that God has ordained the government officials is simply to say he's given them an assignment and authorized them to do that assignment. It doesn't mean that they have done what he said to do. There's a similar passage in 1 Peter chapter 2. And in verse 13 and 14, Peter said, "Therefore submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors, as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good." Now that agrees with what Paul said, that God has ordained the government to praise good behavior and to punish bad behavior. In fact, Paul uses almost those exact words. He says in verse 3 of Romans 13, "For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you'll have praise from the same. For he," that is the government official, "is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil." In other words, when Paul says God has ordained the government officials, he says he has ordained them to be avengers of God's wrath on those who are evil, on criminals. And he has ordained them to praise people who do well. Now, it's true that when Paul describes the rulers, he describes them as if they are doing this very thing, when we know that in some cases they don't. Rulers don't always do what God ordains them to do, in which case they're acting outside of their sphere. This is something many people don't understand. When God ordains authority, whether it's a father's authority over his home, a master's authority over his servants in the Bible, a ruler's authority over a nation, church authorities in the church, when God ordains authority, he doesn't give blanket authority. He doesn't give universal authority that they can do whatever they want to and they're authorized to do it. No one delegates authority like that. Christ alone has all authority in heaven and earth. He said so in Matthew 28:18. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. But he has delegated some authority to persons in different positions or offices. Parents, husbands, masters, rulers, church leaders, and so forth. There's these different positions where God has delegated authority. But when he delegates authority, it's limited authority. It's limited to a certain set of assignments. That'd be the same if you were the owner of a business and you had certain officers in the business, managers and so forth that you'd appointed, or employees. You give them the authority to act within the sphere of their activities that you've given them to do. They can't just go and do something else that's not you haven't authorized them to do and expect to be taken seriously. For example, as a father, my sphere of authority might be my own children. So my children have to obey me. But my neighbor's children don't have to obey me. They're not inside my sphere. You see, inside my sphere of authority, I have authority to tell people what to do. Outside my sphere, I don't. And therefore, to the neighbor children, I'm just another guy. To my kids, I'm the authority. So there's a sphere that God defines for every authority, and that includes government authorities. And when God ordains the government authorities to do what is good and to punish criminals, that's what they're authorized to do. Now, if the government authority turns around and does the opposite and starts punishing the good people and elevating criminals, well, then that authority is not acting within his authority. He's outside his sphere. That's not what he's authorized to do by God. And therefore, the government official that does that is no longer acting authoritatively. A Christian does not have to obey the authority of a man who is not doing what God ordained him or authorized him to do. So what Paul is saying in Romans 13 is, of course, insofar as the government punishes criminals, and all governments do, even the worst governments punish some bad people. All except the very worst governments, do reward good behavior at some level. Unfortunately, certain rulers and governments become so corrupt that they can't tell the difference between good and bad. And they think the Christians are the bad people. And they persecute them. Or they have friends who are indeed bad people, and they give them favor or whatever. When governments do that, they're acting outside the sphere of the authority that Paul is recognizing here. But insofar as a government is punishing, bank robbers and criminals and murderers and rapists and so forth, and most governments do, in fact, do that, maybe not consistently, but insofar as they do it, they are doing what God authorized them to do. And so Paul is saying to the Christians, don't be criminals. Because if you are a criminal, then the government is there ordained by God to punish you. And don't think that, just because you're a Christian, that God's going to get you off the hook when you're a criminal. Criminal Christian. Because God has ordained the government to punish criminals. So Paul is not, as some people just take this to mean that God is in favor of anything that any government official does, and that's not the least what Paul has in mind. Paul doesn't agree with that. Paul believed in civil disobedience, so did Peter and John, so did all godly people throughout history have believed in civil disobedience. If a ruler commands evil or does what is evil, insofar as he's doing that, he's outside his sphere of authority, and Christians have to reject his authority in that particular instance. Now, of course, when the Sanhedrin told Peter and John, stop preaching in the name of Jesus, they had to say, we must obey God rather than man. Now, Peter and John were not just overthrowing the complete authority of the Sanhedrin. They're just saying, this command that you're giving us is outside your sphere. God has told us to preach the gospel. You're telling us not to. obviously God didn't authorize you to tell us not to do what he said to do, you know. So they had to, you have to ignore the commands of authorities which would require you to do what God disapproves of, because clearly God didn't authorize those authorities to disagree with him on those points. But insofar as the same authority does what is right or has laws that are just and reflect, you know, justice or whatever, then we, of course, have to submit to them, even if we don't like them. Was Adolf Hitler ordained by God? Well, he certainly wasn't ordained by God to kill Jews or to invade Poland or anything like that. No, God didn't ordain him to do that. But God did ordain him, as he sat in a position of authority, God ordained Hitler to do a certain thing, and he didn't do it. Just like, you know, some denominations ordain certain pastors to preach the gospel, and they don't do it. To be ordained to do something just means that that's what you've been assigned and authorized to do by an authority over yourself. And God is the authority over all the governments. In fact, Paul's statement that all authority is ordained by God, in a sense, is saying all of them are subject to God. They're not self-authorizing. God's the one who authorizes them and defines the limits of their authority. He's the one who defines their sphere. And so by saying that all authority is ordained by God, one thing Paul is saying is there's no authority that has any right to do anything contrary to God. And once they do, they are, of course, out of order, because God is the one who ordained them and defined what they're supposed to do. Many authorities that have been ordained by God to do what's right have done only wrong. And, of course, they'll have to answer to God for that, as we all must answer to God for our stewardship of our responsibilities. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this every day, Monday through Friday, for a half hour each day. Hope you'll become a regular listener. If you can help support us, it'll keep us on the air more. We do pay for the radio time, and we're entirely dependent on listener support. So if you'd like to keep us on the air where you're listening, you might want to go to our website and see what you can do to keep us on the air. The website is thenarrowpath.com. I'm Steve Gregg. Hope we can talk again tomorrow. God bless.